Welcome to One on One with me, Gareth Cliff. This is our platform that seeks to peel back the layers of intellect, experience, and vision with global and local thought leaders. And it's all right here on the podcast party. These conversations will hopefully give you and me a deeper understanding of the people behind the names, their motivations, and the profound impact of their ideas in shaping the world. Now, today, we bring you no less than a titan of transformation. What do a member of the royal family, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Taylor Swift have in common? I'll tell you, it's the same influence that has bound more than 20 million people in over 60 countries and in 70 languages together. It is the impact of a man called Robin Sharma. Top leadership expert and renowned author Robin Sharma, who gained international recognition with his best-selling book, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. You remember that? That was all the way back in the 90s. But since then, he's continued to offer audiences insights into living a fulfilling and purposeful life. And today he's continuing that aim with a brand new book called The Wealth Money Can't Buy, The 8 Hidden Habits to Live Your Richest Life. I hope by the end of this we'll have discovered what those habits are and how he came to learn of all of this. It is a great pleasure to welcome you, Robin Sharma. How nice to see you.
How nice to see you, Gareth. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I'm very, very excited to talk to you. There's so much we have to get into here. But first, let's just start with your brand new book, because so many people already know you. Many people around the world have already seen what you've done. They've read your books. They've witnessed you firsthand. What's the motivation behind this latest book? And what's happened in the world that needed that in you needed to bring this to fruition?
Well, the motivation behind The Wealth Money Can't Buy is the world has programmed us in many ways. The world has said that you are rich and wealthy if you have a lot of money and a big stock portfolio and a lot of nice things. And so I think what that has done is caused a lot of people to hustle and grind, climbing a mountaintop that only they realize later was the wrong mountain. In the book, there's 8 forms of wealth. Money is one of the forms of wealth. It puts food on the family table, allows us to fulfill our responsibilities, help people in need, but it's only one of the 8 forms of wealth. And so that was the motivation behind the book. I wanted people to understand how to find true wealth and happiness in their life. And then you talk about the context of it. Well, we live in a world of polycrisis. We live in a world where I've never seen so much volatility, negativity, and uncertainty. And so what I was trying to do with the philosophies and habits and methodologies in the book is ground people and help them have a sense of a stronger and brighter future.
I think it's so well timed. And I think that your assessment of how the world is working at the moment or not working is exactly right. But I also think this is the best time people have ever had to be alive. You've got more options than you've ever had. You have access to information that you've never had. You know, we're all very, very lucky to be alive now and not to be in, you know, the throes of a world war or something else. And I know that there are dangers, and I'm sure you do too, but it does strike me as a really good thing to be grateful too for those things that are going on around us. So, Robin, I'm very curious about the origin story of Robin Sharma. And I think that's got its own lessons, some of which you've covered before in previous books, some of which you've spoken about before. But just for people who want an overall context of your life, it all began in Canada, right? And you had parents who were immigrants. I mean, this is a beautiful story. It's worth rehashing.
Well, before I get into the origin story, I just want to touch on your point, Gareth, about gratitude, because it is so important. And often we forget that, yes, it's a time of great uncertainty and social upheaval and cost of living crises and social polarization. And yet we have so many of the benefits only the royalty might have had hundreds of years ago. And it's a strange world, and it's a dark world, and it's a beautiful world with lots of great blessings in it. In terms of my origin story, it started in Africa. And that's why I'm so happy to be here in Cape Town, one of my favorite cities in the world, and here in South Africa, one of my favorite places in the world. I grew up on the east coast of Canada. I come from very humble beginnings, no silver spoon in my mouth. And yeah, I didn't really fit in with most of the people around me. I think I saw the world through a different set of eyes. long story short, I became a lawyer for all the wrong reasons. The world around me said, if you become a lawyer, you'll be happy and you'll be successful. So I made a lot of money. I lived in a lovely place. I had a beautiful car. The only problem is I'd wake up every morning, look in the mirror, and didn't like the man who was looking back at me. So what's the point of being successful in the world and losing yourself in the process? And so I went on a bit of an adventure, discovering healers and reading different books and interviewing elders and learning how to meditate and journal and try all these different modalities. I made a fairly profound transformation in my life. I decided there was like an instinct to write about it. So I self-published a book called The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari in a 24-hour coffee shop. My mom was my first editor. My father helped me sell it at service clubs. And the book somehow traveled around the world through word of mouth. And it led me down this rabbit hole where here I'm speaking to you in South Africa, Gareth.
I love that story. I also love the fact that you kept 2,000 copies of the book in the kitchen at one stage when you needed to sell them. You were giving to family members and friends that they'd spread the word. You know, a lot of people think you have to have some enormous good fortune, some stroke of luck that's going to propel you into the stratosphere. But sometimes it just takes a little patience and hard work. And I know people don't like to hear that, especially people in their 20s. But to go through a transformation like that, I mean, it also must strike many as, you know, being, it looks like sometimes it's some kind of binary choice, right? And it isn't. It's actually a complex set of options that you took into consideration there. What was actually going through your head when you decided, I'm going to give this up, which looks like a good deal, and I'm going to go for this, which looks like, you know, an ascetic life, kind of meditating and living in Tibet or whatever it might be to people who have these ideas?
Well, I wish it was as romantic as an ascetic life and living like a monk. But what was going through my mind is that instinct is so much more powerful than intellect. And I just had I think the ego screams and the spirit whispers. And I just had these whispers of you've got to do this and you can do this. It made no sense at all. I mean, someone who was a lawyer and successful in the world, leaving my law position and self-publishing a book. But to speak to your point about luck, I think you don't get lucky, you make lucky. And it is stunning how far you can get if you stay in the game longer than the world thinks you should. I mean, I was laughed at a lot. People actually laughed at the title, The Monk Who Sold His Ferrari. I had a lot of doors shut in my face. I didn't really know the publishing business, but I learned it. And I learned how to write better. And I learned how to get the right cover. And I think there's an old expression, it's not mine, but synchronicity is God's way of remaining anonymous. And I think when you put good into the world and you do it with faith and good intention, and you put in the sweat equity around your ethical ambitions, amazing things will happen. One of my favorite brain tattoos is small, daily, seemingly insignificant improvements when done consistently over time lead to stunning results. And we live in a world where we want our ideals and our Mount Everests to be real instantly, but often we forget that it requires sometimes 20 years of anonymous quietly working on our vision when the world is laughing at us and we're facing resistance, but we're still pushing day by day. And we forget that every little act is part of that climb up to the Mount Everest. And then lo and behold, one day it all comes together and then the world says, oh, you got lucky.
Sure. I mean, that's so right. Just a couple of words of encouragement to those people who are afraid, because there are so many of us who, you know, when you're in a secure, let's say it's a financially secure position, or you're in a secure position in your relationship, but you're not really pushing yourself and you're probably not doing what you should be doing. The amount of courage required to tip you over the edge, to make that difficult decision, to step out of security and to actually chase your dreams, How do you get people past that point? Because I think that's probably one of the toughest things most people will ever do.
I'd say three things. I would say courage is a muscle.
Yeah.
We're not born with heroic courage. Courage is built by micro bravery, the consistent and daily doing of things that we're scared to do builds courage. My life changed a number of years ago when I took the ferry from Cape Town and went to Robben Island, and I saw the limestone quarry where Nelson Mandela did backbreaking labor for, I believe it was 8 years. He damaged his eyes. He damaged his lungs from the dust from the limestone. I saw the courtyard where he would exercise with his fellow prisoners. And then I was led up to his prison cell, you know, incredibly small, not even a bed in there. And, you know, I talked to someone who, I actually talked to the guide who was showing me around. And I said, did you know Nelson Mandela? And he said, yes, I knew him very well. I said, why? And he said, I served with him for 7 years here on Robben Island. And then as you might ask Gareth, I said, you know, what was he like? And the guide said, well, that man was a humble servant. I also learned that Nelson Mandela became Nelson Mandela on Robben Island. And so what I'm suggesting is difficulty, whether it's tragedy or whether it's some small difficulty, but it's by leaning into the things that make us feel frightened and uncomfortable that we grow in courage. Second thing I'd say to someone who's afraid to take a risk, the discomfort of change is always less than the heartbreak of regret.
Oh.
And what I mean by that is, look, I feel scared at times making changes, but I know that it's absolutely mission essential for me to consistently do the things I'm frightened to do, for me to get to the last hour of my last day and say, I didn't waste my life. And so I would rather face discomfort and do the things that I'm frightened to do than get to my deathbed and say, I wasted a life. I never built intimacy with my gifts and my talents. I never got to do great things. And then the final thing I would say, one of the early chapters of The Wealth Money Can't Buy comes from an experience I had in Dubai. And the journalist said, you know, this is all great. Love it. Love the principles. Love the habits. Love the tools. Where do we start? And my reply was, the best place to start is just to start. And often we make things too complicated. You know, where do I start? How do I make the leap? If you want to write the next globally number one best-selling book, write the first paragraph today. If you want to run a marathon, get off the sofa and go for your first walk. If you want to find true love at the grocery store today, when you're in the avocado section, go over and talk to someone that you're attracted to that's holding an avocado and have a conversation. But the only failure is the failure to try, and the best way to start is just to start.
I love it. Okay, if anybody isn't listening, then I mean you missed out on kind of the masterclass of masterclasses there. So Robin, I mean, you don't like it when people call you a motivational speaker, and I can't blame you, because there's so many people who call themselves motivational speakers that are really like charlatans and they're always positive, but it turns out to be an act, because you can't put that on every day. And you've said that what you're really doing is you're giving people the tools to improve themselves, efficiencies, to make themselves more integrated, to do all the things that really you should be able to do in a world where you had all the resources, you had the right kind of love as a child, all of that sort of stuff. Motivational speakers, I've got to tell you, I've never liked any of them. But I think you are a completely different kettle of fish. You're optimizing people.
Well, I don't like the term motivational speaker, because to me, it sometimes suggests that the ideas are fleeting. And, you know, I think there's some very good motivational speakers out there. And I think there's a place for them, you know, maybe at a sales conference where you need to rally the troops. I think it's a real art to be a great motivational speaker. But that's not what I do, as you say, Gareth. What I do is, I help people remember their primal genius with a lot of science, as well as a lot of philosophy in my books and in my talks and videos. I believe every single human being on the planet is born into genius, and then we get resigned into mediocrity. And at the beginning of The Wealth Money Can't Buy, I actually talk about the five forces of Penum, which is an acronym that actually explains how we lose our connection with our true power, our creativity, our bravery, and the love in our hearts. And Penum stands for parents, environment, nation, associations, and media. And these five forces actually create what psychologists call a perceptual filter. Because as you know so well, we see the world not as it is, we see the world as we are. And maybe I can say that again, because I hopefully it'll be helpful to people. We see the world not as it is, we see the world as we are, or maybe more accurately, as we have become through the micro and macro trauma and programming of those five forces, our parents and the media and our environment. And so what starts to happen is we lose access to our heroic selves, and we forget who we truly are. And we wake up at 30 or 40 or 50 or 80. And too many good souls are operating as victims, giving away our power, saying we can't do amazing things, we can't launch a business, can't run a marathon, can't be great in our careers, can't find true love, can't find an impact. But we have that.
Sorry to interrupt. I mean, what you're saying there is just the most valuable thing. And to not put too fine a point on it, this idea of being a victim has become kind of trendy now. You see a lot of people, it's become very cool to be a victim. The more you can say you've been put upon by your parents, the environment, your nation, the media, the more attention you will get from other people who feel put upon. And I just love the fact that you say you've only got two choices here. You're either going to be a victor or a victim. Am I right, or am I paraphrasing you a little too much?
No, it is right. Victims are all about CBE, complaint, blame, and excuse. And the very tragic thing about excuses is the more we actually recite them, the more we mesmerize and hypnotize ourselves to think they are true. And you can tell a victim a mile away, and I'm not judging, I'm just reporting, I'm not complaining, I'm just saying victims, you can tell them a mile away by their language, because the language telegraphs the beliefs. The language is of I can't versus I can. The language is here's the problem versus the possibility. The language is of powerlessness. But if you look at a lot of the great women and men of the world, they suffered. And they came from very hard circumstances, but they steadily took micro steps each day, because what you do every day is so much more important than what you do once in a while. And your day is your life in miniature. So if you do little positive things every day, it is stunning what they stack into over time. And sometimes it's you read one page of one book, or you watch one video where someone is offering you some real insight or real tactic to uplift your productivity or your energy or your positivity or the way you do your work. And that one idea causes a behavioral change over time that leads you to a completely new place. So, and I do agree, I think it's a very profound point you're making. We do live in a world where I think too many good souls are wearing their victimhood as badges of honor. And I actually think leadership and owning your power and doing beautiful work and uplifting other people is a very spiritual enterprise, because I think when you live your promise and when you live your gifts and you reach for your greatest self, I think you're honoring God, and I think you're honoring the best within you. And I think it also sends a signal to the people around you of what they can do as well.
Well, I noticed in some of the notes that I made here, you have little time for indolence or snowflakery. And you say, I have to be very careful. I don't want to be canceled for the rest of my life. But I think there's a lot of entitlement in the world right now. Some people are extraordinarily thin-skinned. I mean, even our leaders, right? The people who purport to be in charge of things, who we trust with making the major decisions around our nations and our jobs and our society. a lot of these people don't know what they're doing, and they appear to me to also have a sense of entitlement and be a little disconnected from themselves.
I think most of us on the planet are disconnected from ourselves. I think most of us alive today have been programmed to follow the crowd, to spend our finest hours of our greatest days as cyber zombies, watching dancing puppy videos and celebrities coming out of restaurants with beautiful clothes. And I think the tragedy of that is we never get the time we waste back. And I think the tragedy of that is we get hooked into spending our best days in trivial pursuits. And what I'm trying to do with the Wealth Money Can't Buy and the 8 forms of wealth is give people the 8 areas to focus on steadily day by day that will bring true happiness and true inner peace and a true sense of fulfillment.
All right, so let's just talk about those 8 other, well, the 7 other forms of wealth. You told us money is already one of them. And without knowing, because I haven't seen the book yet, because I know it's coming and you're going to be in South Africa. We'll talk about that in a minute. But I imagine one of them is time. That's always something that you realize very quickly is valuable, time. I would imagine love is another form of wealth. Am I even in the ballpark here, or will you direct me back in?
You are, for sure. So the 5th form of wealth is money, and I want to be very careful. This book is not in any way saying there's anything wrong with material things. We're human beings. Right. I think most of us would rather have a nice journey through life than a difficult journey through life. So the 5th form of wealth is money. There's 25 chapters where I deconstruct how the billionaires I've mentored for 15 plus years, how they do it, how they think, what their daily habits are, what their strategies are. Having said that, there are a lot of very rich people financially that are cash rich and their life poor. There's actually a chapter in that section called The Multi-Billionaire in the Very Empty Mansion. I've met so many billionaires that I've mentored. People think these people must be the happiest people in the world. Many of them are miserable. Their children won't talk to them. They're medicating themselves with too much alcohol or too many drugs or too much work. And a lot of them really are cash rich, but they're spirit poor. So money is the 5th form of wealth. What are the other 7 forms of wealth? The first form of wealth is growth. Now, our culture doesn't say you're growing and you're becoming braver and you're removing timidity and you're becoming less jealous and you're becoming wiser and more loving, you're rich. But it really is a currency money can't buy to fulfill your promise and to get to know your gifts and your talents. 2nd form of wealth in the book is wellness. So in one wisdom tradition, they say, health is the crown on the well person's head that only the ill person can see. In another wisdom tradition, they say, when we are young, we would sacrifice all of our health for wealth. And when we get old and figure out what life is all about, we would sacrifice all of our wealth for one day of good health. Health is one of those things we take for granted until we lose it. 3rd form of wealth, family, to have a great home life, to have a great relationship with your parents and your significant other and your children or your boyfriend, girlfriend, to have great friends, wonderful conversations, to love and to have people who love you is a form of wealth. 4th form of wealth, craft. Whether you are a street sweeper, a taxi driver, an astronaut, a poet, a company leader, doing your work with dignity. You know, I think you're in Joburg, and there's a man, I hope he's still there. His name is Arun Jubalani, and he's in the domestic terminal of the Johannesburg airport. And I met him about 15 years ago, and he is the janitor in the men's room. And when I walked in, he said, welcome to my office.
Yeah, I know him. He's still there. You know, yeah.
And I'll never forget it. You know, he said, I'm like the ambassador of South Africa. And I said, your washroom is so clean. He said, well, my work is important to me. And he had a smile on his face. And, you know, to me, that's a titan. That's a titan. So fourth form of wealth is doing your work, whatever it is, with a sense of pride, excellence, mastery. It's good for the world. It's good for you. Fifth form of wealth is money. Sixth form of wealth is what I call community in the book. Stripping out the energy vampires, the dream stealers, filling your social orbit with people whose lives you want to be living as a form of wealth money can't buy. Seventh form of wealth is adventure. We can get into it. Eighth form of wealth is service, to live for something that's bigger than yourself, and to be generous versus selfish is a form of wealth.
I love it. Each one of these means so much, because when you think about what you, and everybody who's listening to this now will be thinking, how do I rack up in each of those categories? How am I doing? Because you do get a sense that some people prioritize one of these categories more than all the others, to the detriment sometimes of all the others. And then they wonder why down the line they're so miserable and unhappy. It seems to me that you've zeroed in on the most valuable little collection of things that we should all keep track of every day. And as you say, each day is a micro. Is it true, by the way, that you exercise both in the morning and in the evening?
Yes, it is. I exercise at 5 a.m. and then I do what I call the second wind workout, which is like I'll go for an hour walk, or I'll go for a mountain bike ride, or go for a swim later in the day. Because if you believe that exercise is a complete game changer, which it is, then why would you only do it once? Why would you only do it once a day? And you make a key point, which is these eight forms of wealth, really, as far as I can tell, and I've been in this field of leadership and personal mastery for 31 years, as far as I can tell, these eight forms of wealth are the essential fields, or the essential eight areas, which as we score higher, give us our finest lives. Having said that, I remember I was in a little plane from White River, South Africa, to another place. I think it was into Kruger. And the pilot let me fly the plane for a few minutes. And he said, you know, there was, I guess it's an altimeter or something, but he said, just keep it level. And as we'd fly, the currents would take me off and then I'd have to get it level again. And all I'm trying to say is, yes, these eight forms of wealth are the ideal. It's the mountaintop. But every single day, like that plane, we get pulled off track. And the key is just to do our best every day to come back to that level on the eight forms, on the eight forms of wealth.
You know what's so great about all these books you've written, and if I go through the list, it's just incredible. Here are some of the books that people might have forgotten too. There's Powerful Secrets of Getting to World Class. There's More Insights to Get You to World Class. There's The Leader Who Had No Title. The 5 a.m. Club, which a lot of people I know are massive fans of. But over all these years of wisdom and kind of speaking to so many other people who you've gained and garnered this wisdom from and helped to compile these incredible books, out of all of this, what's changed since the days of the monk who sold his Ferrari? What did you have to come back and revise? Because either circumstances have changed, or maybe the inputs have become different. What are the biggest things that you've look back on? And I mean, there are very few people who can go back and look at a book that's almost 40 years old and say, there's nothing wrong with this, right?
Wow. I've never been asked that. I would say, I just made some replies on the notepad in front of me. I would say, when I first started out, a lot of the successful athletes and entrepreneurs, et cetera, let's say successful people, they all read personal development books, or many of them did, but they hid them in their nightside table. It was almost as if personal development and self-growth, self-help, let's call it, was embarrassing. So the world has changed. I was just in Exclusive Books down at the waterfront, one of my favorite bookstores in South Africa. And as soon as you walk in, what's the first rack? It's self-help. So self-help has gone mainstream. Instagram is pretty much a self-help nation, if you know what I mean. And trauma, people talk about trauma, micro trauma, macro trauma. People talk about healing. Silicon Valley companies talk about mindfulness, which is really just meditation. So I would say the first thing that's changed is personal growth has gone mainstream. And that is a symptom of a much healthier world. Second thing I would say, there's a lot more science, and you might find this interesting, Gareth. Science is simply confirming what the philosophers have said for hundreds of years. So now people love self-help because there's science that confirms meditation, or science that talks about journaling or resilience or being in nature or solitude or saunas or cold water or goal setting. Like, the science backs it up. We talk about the neuroscience behind it. So people now believe it. Yet the philosophers, maybe some of the monks and people like the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius, and a lot of the great philosophers, even a lot of great self-help books in the past, they were talking about the same things, but now science is confirming it. So many, the mainstream believes it more and gives it more credibility. And then I think maybe the third thing, we could go on about this, but I'd say the third thing is, I think the world is more complex than ever before. According to the latest research, on the average day, the average person spends 4.7 hours a day on their phone. So a lot of us say, well, I don't have time to read. I don't have time to build my career. I don't have time to meditate. I don't have time to work on myself and journal. And yet that's 3 months we're on a phone every year. So, and I mentioned journaling just to hopefully bring some value to your many listeners and followers. One of my practices, we can get into my current morning practice if you want. It starts at 4 a.m. and it ends at 8. And I'm no guru. I'm no special person, but it's changing my life and the life of my clients. And one of the parts of my morning practice, my morning ritual, is in my journal, I run a tool called the 5-Question Morning Maximizer. If you want to get into it, we can, but I'll quickly, if I may, tell you the five questions. Yeah. So I ask myself 5 questions every morning with a good cup of coffee. Sometimes it's a paragraph. Sometimes the answer is longer. First question, what am I grateful for? Gratitude is the antidote to fear. Gratitude circumvents the negativity bias of the human brain. There's lots of great science, especially from people like Sonia Lubomirsky, who's found the happiest people in the world practice deliberate gratitude. Second question, where am I winning? In our days, we often focus on the curses versus the blessings, but when you focus on where you're winning, especially the micro wins, it increases your hope, energy, momentum. Third question, very powerful. What will I let go of today? One of the first chapters in the growth section of The Wealth Money Can't Buy is do not be a resentment collector. So take out your pen and answer the question, what will I let go of today? It could be some resentment, some jealousy you're feeling against a peer in your field. Could be a little bit of heartbreak you're carrying from someone who wronged you. That's healing in one paragraph. Fourth question, what does my ideal day ahead look like? Clarity precedes mastery. So writing a few lines about your ideal day ahead allows you to be strategic versus reactive. And your days are your life in miniature. Create great days. They become great weeks, quarters, years, decades, and a great lifetime. Fifth and final question in this morning tool that if you use it for about 30 days, will have some amazing, amazing results. What needs to be said at the end? Could you imagine every morning you write a paragraph? And you say, here's what I want my family, my friends, my coworkers, my neighbors, the world to say about me the day after I die. That allows you to live to the point versus living 80 years of the same day and calling it a lifetime.
With that last question, which I love, do you often end up with the same answer at the beginning of every day? What needs to be said at the end? Is it sometimes a repeat?
It is. And, you know, I'm a huge fan of journaling, and we often wonder, if I write the same things every day, is it wrong? And by the way, I can see you now when I'm chatting, and I love it more. It's even more of a conversation. I don't think there's anything wrong with writing about your future every day. It'll cement it. I don't think there's anything wrong with writing in your journal, I want to be braver and more loving and less insecure and less petty. I mean, writing in a journal is so powerful for becoming the human being you want to be.
When you talk about what you'll let go of, and you kind of hinted at this earlier when it came to the community part of your other forms of wealth, a lot of us do have to get rid of bad energy. It could be people who are just not, they just don't sync with you anymore. It could be that things have changed. It could be a relationship where you're just not loving each other anymore. It's turned sour. It could be in business where there've been, different agendas. For many people, it's difficult because, again, security with money makes you hold on to a job you shouldn't for too long. Feelings will make people stay in a relationship too long, long after the magic's gone. How do you get out of that?
You get out of that.
Just go. Do it.
And I'm smiling because it's hard. I hear you. And it's not that hard. You just realize you have one life to live, and you can live your best life, or you can be around an energy vampire, and you can't do both. And I have mentored so many people over many decades where they say, I don't know why. I wish I had left the relationship sooner. It wasn't as hard as I thought it would be. And thankfully, I'm out of it. I would also say, because you hint at a very important point. In business, sometimes, let's say it's a business partner, someone who could have been perfect at a certain part of the life cycle of the business might not be the ideal person now. And I think it's very stressful to keep a C player in an A player position. And often we do them a favor to move on. In an intimate relationship, with friends, I'd say, someone could have been your best friend 10 years ago, but you're on a path of growth. And not that many people are maximizing their genius and reading and listening to podcasts like yours, Gareth, and audiobooks and journaling and going to courses. And so if your best friend isn't growing, you will outgrow your friend, and that's okay. And then in an intimate relationship, I would offer you an idea, which is reason, season, lifetime. People come into our life for a reason, a season, and a few for a lifetime. And if someone no longer fits and you're feeling it's toxic and they're bringing you down every day, then what I would say is love them from afar. You can still have love in your heart for someone who is no longer in your life. Wish them well on their journey, and you get busy living your finest journey.
Yeah, it's for some people, it's easier said than done, but you're right. You just got to do it, right? So there's no perfect time for any of this stuff. Robin, you know, I often think that when I'm talking to someone like you who has this huge volume, this corpus of wisdom, and you've spoken not just from you, but obviously from all the people you've interacted with over the years, a lot of people feel like they need something special or magical to happen, or they complain that they've got some sort of condition. I mean, I met truly talented and brilliant people who say, oh, no, I can't do that because I'm anxious, or because I suffer from this, or I've got that. It's like a magic spell in reverse. It puts them in a position where it's not their fault they can't achieve these things. And they don't have the magic that you do, or that I do, or that someone else does. So it becomes an excuse. And I don't want to go back into that conversation about the victim, but I do think for a lot of people, they don't see themselves as a victim. They see things as being hugely unfair. What do you say to that?
I'd say I completely agree with you. I'd also say magic takes 30 years of hard work. You know, we see Taylor Swift on the stage. We listen to Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. We go to a beautiful art gallery. I'm such a fan of South African art. Lionel Smith and William Kentridge and all the other amazing artists here. I just love South African art, but they didn't have magic.
No.
They put in the sweat equity. You know, I don't know if you know this, but this is a documented fact. The first 10 years of Mozart's composing were mere curiosities. It was only after 10 years of practice, focus, devotion, discipline, sacrifice, that his first signs of genius presented themselves. And we could talk about the 10,000-hour rule. And to give credit where it's due, that comes from a man named Anders Ericsson. Anders Ericsson of Florida State University. It was his research that found that in athletics, et cetera, chess champions, they spent roughly 10,000 hours of practice on their singular skill before they could bend the ball like Beckham. So for anyone, and I hear that a lot, and they say, oh, that billionaire got lucky, or that athlete had natural talent. Mm-hmm. Or that entrepreneur, or that person, the manager on the shop floor who gets promoted. Well, they're lucky.
Yeah.
Luck is less about luck and more about strategy and discipline and putting in the effort. And the irony is, you know, doing these things, whether it's joining the 5 a.m. club, whether it's personal growth, whether it's putting down your phone and reading so you study your craft, whether it's treating people well and leaving people better than you found them. It might seem like a lot of work, but it turns into fun. You know, I get up at 4 o'clock these days, and that sounds like a radical idea to a lot of people. And they roll their eyes and they say, that's crazy. And they say, I could never do that. Kind of what you're suggesting. I could never do that. He must have something I don't have. Why would he do it? It's crazy. Well, first of all, I'm not sleep depriving. I sleep at 9:30 or 10. So right. It's not about sleep deprivation. But secondly, why do I do it? Because it's so fun. What could be more fun than getting up with the sun and working out, moving your body, learning, writing in a journal, drinking good coffee, closing your eyes and doing MVP, meditation, visualization, and prayer, and seeing how you want to be and the life you want to create. Like, I think watching silly videos or over chatting or oversleeping, that's misery versus fun.
Yeah. Oh, spot on. Just to go back to your routine, because you fast as well, which you found to be tremendously helpful. And I think probably for a lot of people, they want to take away some practical tip apart from the questions, the different forms of wealth, the things that you do, the time you wake up. What sort of actual input should you have when it comes to, because they, you know, there's this maxim about what you put into your body, you'll get out. And fasting is obviously a way of making your body do things that it would do in the ancient times of our ancestors, when food wasn't just on the supermarket shelf, right?
Yes. So that's the second form of wealth and the wealth money can't buy, which is wellness. And on fasting, there's a chapter called Go OMAD, which is an acronym for one meal a day. Now, I want to be super clear. I'm not giving any medical advice. And OMAD is, I'm suggesting, one day a week, only have one meal. And the other two meals or more that you would have eaten, give them to someone in need. So you get a gift and you give someone else a gift. Now, why should we fast? Autophagy. Autophagy is when you go into fasted state. Let's say you just eat breakfast and then you have nothing until the next day. Your body goes into autophagy, which is a cellular cleansing mechanism, which has been shown to extend life, clean out your system. Secondly, when you fast, your brain releases a fascinating neuroregulator called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, which actually accelerates processing. And I kind of think, Garrett, that's why a lot of the saints and the great movement makers, that's why they fasted, because it would allow them to enter more clear, wiser, and more powerful realms of perception.
Okay, it sounds like it's not just for the body, it's also for the mind. Spirituality. I mean, if there's a pyramid, then it's physical, mental, emotional, spiritual, or some combination of those. What do you think happens to us at the end? You talk about at the end what people will say about you. Are you curious about, do you have any ideas about, any philosophy, any guiding thoughts about what might happen when it's all over? It would be a shame to have a brain like yours just exist for a window of time and then disappear. I mean, it'll live on in the writings and everything and conversations like this. But what do you think happens to you?
Well, you're very kind, Gareth. I would say a few things. In my last book, The Everyday Hero Manifesto, I addressed that. There was a chapter where I said, death is just a hotel room upgrade. And so I kind of think that when we die, we're all scared of death. And by the way, bonus point, if we, most of us have an ambient fear of death running through us every minute of every day. And if we could just be at peace with death, we would be so much braver. But what do I think? I think when we die, we're in a life right now is a 3 or 4 star hotel. When we die, we get to go to a 5 star hotel with better coffee and a nicer gym. I'm excited about possibilities. Second thing I would say is for years, I've been talking about the importance of legacy, right? You were suggesting it, like to live in a way that when we die, our reputation lives on. And I used to think that was important. Now I couldn't care less about my legacy because when I die, and my goal is to be 100 and healthy at 101 and then just check out from the stage.
Right.
So I biohack and sleep and all those important things. But when I die, let's be honest, I will be a pile of dust in an urn on a mantel place over a fireplace next to cricket, rugby, and maybe some football trophies. Like, who cares? I have to give credit to Marcus Aurelius in Meditations for this. He said, most of the kings and queens who were so important on the planet, we don't even remember them anymore. So I'm not worried about how I'm remembered after I die. I couldn't care less. I'm concerned about how I live while I get to be alive.
I think that's the perfect place to end it. I could talk to you all day. I'd love to. I think everybody who gets to spend some time with you during this trip on this turnaround in South Africa is very, very lucky. I would encourage anybody who hasn't already got themselves a copy of this book. I mean, I've made notes. I've been making notes the whole way through this. So now I'm going to have to read it all in detail. But I suggest that you should check out the new book from this brilliant man, Robin Sharma. And we'll give you all the details. We'll post it all on the link in the episode down here below. And I hope that you will go and check it out. The new book is called The Wealth Money Can't Buy. And it is about the 8 forms of wealth that you don't think about all the time and you probably should. I mean, just another brilliant work from Robin. Robin, it's so nice to see you. And thank you very much for making time with us.
I hope to see you again, Gareth. And I want to congratulate you not only for your podcast, but the influence and impact you've had on millions of people. So thank you.
Oh, that's kind of you. Thank you so much. Coming from you, that's a great compliment. Thank you, Robin.